This week in Retronauts, it's the world's greatest toy store. Let's go! Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts, episode 664. Ooh. It's one door down from the Beast. I am Jeremy Parrish, and with me this week we have some of the usual jokers, familiar voices that you'll know, but also a new face that you can't see because it's an audio podcast. However, his voice will also be accompanying us, and this episode exists really at his pleasure. Please introduce yourself, newcomer, and let us know what's going on with this episode.
Thanks, Jeremy. I'm Jeff Vlasic. Ironically, I was on, this podcast about 2 years ago with Stu talking Lego games, which is funny. This morning, I remembered that we had discussed why they never made like a James Bond Lego game. And then about 3 weeks ago, a trailer kind of got unceremoniously dumped for a Traveler's Tales game that never got done for James Bond.
Yeah,
so
I remember that.
What a pity. But anyway, yes. No, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I want to see the tiny little Lego chair where James Bond can sit, and tiny little Machief has like a little brick to smack against his testicles.
Those little sort of single studs could be his nards, maybe. That would be fun.
Boy, those are some big nards. Yeah, boy. Yeah,
I mean, who has bigger balls than James Bond? Okay, we're already working blue. It's a Sunday morning, right after Christmas. Let's go.
Oh, so yes, I'm happy to be on the podcast again. As I mentioned, it's been a long time, but I've been a long time subscriber. I'm not in the games industry apart from, well, I guess what we're going to talk about today, my brief stint of selling video games, which is kind of what the impetus for this episode was. It's one of those things where, you know, between the four of us, I'm not going to guess what our average age is, but we've all lived through the era of going to the store to physically buy games, as well as, I guess, the sort of digital revolution where now you don't have to wait at all, and the many complications that come with that, which, like, once again, to make our lives easier, it's also made them more complicated. So, but again, looking forward to talking today about all our various experiences from across the globe, since I think this might be the most miles I've covered on a single Zoom call. I mean, this is normal for you guys, but this is totally outlandish for me. So
I will say that when it comes to talking about our ages, my age is the equivalent of the Russian judges score, and it gets thrown out as the outlier. I think pretty much anyone who likes video games has the experience of buying video games, unless you're just very fortunate and somehow they appear right there for you every morning, like manna from heaven. But I don't think that actually happens to a lot of people. So it's a relatable topic. And yeah, I know for myself, buying video games, when I think about it, I sort of divide it into different ages, like periods of my life. Like before Jeremy had a video game system, before Jeremy had a part-time job, before Jeremy had a full-time job, before Jeremy was in the games press, before Jeremy left the games press. And each of those has, like, a different drive has propelled me and advised my reckless spending habits. So we'll talk about that sort of thing, I believe, over the next hour and a half. But before we do that, the other two people need to introduce themselves. And therefore, I turn it over to the person who is furthest into the future, traveling through a time warp portal to Hardoff. And maybe you'd better explain what that means.
I will, but my name is Diamond Fight, and I'm buying video games right now. Not a bit. I actually bought some video games as we spoke.
Okay. Did you buy them just to have that bit?
Well, I timed it that way, but yes.
Dare we ask what game it is? Games they are?
Oh, sure. I bought a game that's apparently named it for myself called The Crimson Diamond, and a sequel to a game I liked very much, which is called Platform 8. The original was called Exit 8. Hmm. But yes, I'm reporting today from a virtual the virtual Hardoff by way of my Zoom background, which is a very stylish image brought to us by the Hardoff Corporation, which is a chain of used goods retailers here in Japan with the idea that, you know, Book Off sells books and games and movies, whereas Hard Off, short for hardware, sells larger, more standalone type stuff. But you can still go there and find games and movies or whatever. But it's like a bigger store. It's usually in suburban areas. A friend of the show, James Eldred, loves to go to Hard Off and take pictures of the stuff he finds there. And it looks really cool. And I haven't been to Hard Off in a long time. So I should probably go real soon to scratch that itch.
All right. And I will give a quick shout out to the Crimson Diamond, which was created by, I guess, a friend of the show, someone who is an extraordinarily talented lady, Julia Minamata, who created EGA-style portraits for me for the Limited Run Games History of Monkey Island book that I put together a few years ago.
Wow!
Oh, cool.
And all the designers that she interpreted in EGA-style graphics were, I think, very impressed to see, you know, their portraits transform that way. Except one person who was like, oh, you picked that picture of me to work from? Like, I don't know, dude. It's what's on the internet. Come on. Anyway.
So my bit was relevant. Wow.
Yeah. Amazing. No, I feel like anyone who likes Sierra-style PC adventures would enjoy the Crimson Diamond.
Yeah. I only found out about it the other day, and then I found out that they've made all these different kind of affectations to sort of the balance to make the game actually fair, you know, and not frustrating. So that put me off quite a lot because, you know, that's not...
That's not really the Stuart style.
No, I'm kidding. I will be getting that game. I'm looking forward to that. I'm just kidding. Oh, I should introduce myself, shouldn't I?
Oh, right.
Hello. I'm Stuart Jip. I'm not buying games right now, and I've actually never bought a game before in my life, and I hope that's not going to be a problem for this.
No, we understand the, you know, austerity and the five-finger discount. It's totally understood.
You're British. You just take things. I understand.
Yes.
No, we, like I said before the podcast recording started, we brought you on here specifically so that you can evoke the phrase, the high street.
That is, that's all I'm going to do.
20 minutes talking about that.
And I'm going to do it, and then I'm going to be like, well, my work here is done. Actually, there is quite a lot of stuff to say about British buying video games in Britain, but we'll see if it comes up, because it might not be relevant enough to my very own special UK episode of Buying Games.
Usually when we do a podcast, not usually, but often when we do a podcast, I like to say, what was your first experience with the subject we are currently discussing? But that seems like it might be a little bit of a challenge for you to travel back through the mists of time and pick out the first video game you ever bought. So instead, I will invert it and say, do you still buy video games? Now, Diamond has already spoiled their answer, but that's okay. I'm curious to hear about the rest of you. Jeff, do you still buy video games?
I do. It being the Christmas season, I was going to say, I bought Indiana Jones and the Great Circle, which is a nice throwback to, I guess, bringing full circle, to my kind of video game career. But I also bought Tetris Forever for my wife for Christmas, which was a debacle because she has a separate Switch than me. And because it only exists in digital form, I had to sneak onto her Switch, find out what her password was, and download it for her because I couldn't just buy a gift card, which, again, the lovely walled garden of Nintendo products, which, again, if you just went to Toys R Us back in the 80s, wasn't really an issue, has made it exceptionally difficult to surprise someone and give them mana on their Switch on Christmas morning. So the short answer is yes, I still do buy video games because I'm an adult with money, and that's what I do. So...
All right. And Stuart, what about you?
I'm an adult without money, but I somehow still managed to buy video games, yeah. I think the last video game I bought was probably Astrobot. That was a waste of...
Really? That's a contrary opinion. I suppose I shouldn't be surprised, but...
It's fine. It's like... You know, it's a game where all you can do is jump and hit things, like a Lego game, which is, you know. But if all you can do is jump or hit things, I want one of those things to be interesting. And then neither of them are. They're just a single jump and a hover and a punch. And, like, you get some other stuff, which is, like, on the shoulder buttons, and that's just a load of old wank. Boring. But yeah, it's all right. I also don't like Astrobot himself. He looks like he's going to sell me a mobile contract. I hate him. He's awful. He's like a little Funko Pop. I won't say the word because I've refused. I've not allowed myself to say it on this podcast, but you know what word it is. You all know what word it is. You've all seen my social media. He's one of those.
Is it Jerk?
Rapscallion. Roustabout.
Blue also, I see.
You know, I'd wager that thanks to the recent holiday season, I may have bought Stuart's most recent gift. I sent him a game for Christmas.
Aw.
It was very nice of you. And now you've put me on the spot, and I have to acknowledge it. I hate thanking people for things.
I kind of hope it was Astrobot.
I don't like being no. grateful. Yeah, that would have been really. That would have been good. No, it was EDF6, which I actually haven't tried yet, but I will. The problem is, I'm just really scared of ants. They terrify me. So that's going to be a huge obstacle for me, you know. Mm. But I bought that. I buy things on the Switch, I have to be honest. I'm less of a physical games guy. I'm not really that bothered about physical games. I find them quite annoying because they're just there, you know? They're kind of in your space, and I really need space. But I did buy Astrobot for physical because I thought it wouldn't like it, and I don't like it that much, so I can get rid of it, which is great, you know? It's not stuck digitally on my account forever, which has been a problem in the past. But, yeah, mostly digital these days, and sometimes Mega Drive cartridges off eBay. But, you know, that's a different thing. That's more about having the little object to look at rather than actually play the game.
As for myself, I really have been trying not to buy video games of late. I've accumulated a ton of games for work projects, you know, videos and books and things like that. And at this point, I have... I'm looking at like 12 banker's boxes worth of NES and Super NES games that I really want to sell and get out of my home. I have these things. I no longer need them. I have enough materials for like 3 or 4 years of videos. And at this point, they're just kind of taking up space. I recently moved to, like a year ago, moved to a new house and finally got my personal office organized and have bookshelves and shelves for records and stuff. And there ended up not being any shelves for games. And that, to me, became a sign to say, you don't need these. You work with them all the time. You're surrounded by them. Please do something with your life besides dealing with video games. And so... that is my new guiding mission. So if someone wants to buy a lot of NES games from me, shoot me a message. It's an amazing collection of 1988, 89, and 90 NES games. Incredible stuff. But no, I do still buy some games. Sometimes I even get games that I am not going to turn into content on the internet. And it's pretty wild. It does happen. I don't actually get to play them, but I do buy them. In this sort of futile sense of optimism mm-hmm. that someday I will have some free time. And, you know, if I retire, I'm going to have so many Switch games to play. It is just going to be phenomenal. It's going to be, it's going to carry me to my deathbed. So, you know, that's good.
Yeah. And it will be handy to have a Switch in your deathbed, won't it? Because it will be portable and,
you can
prop it up with the stand if you need to.
It might still work.
It's funny that you mentioned that, and actually this touches on what you were saying a second ago, Stuart, about how the digital versus physical. I joke with my friends and my wife, she's tired of hearing it, but regardless of your creed or faith, et cetera, I hope that after death I get some kind of like post-death debriefing, right? Like a big kind of like the beginning of Loki, where they kind of go through and say, look, this is your life. And somewhere on that wall, I want to see a graph that shows the number of games I bought like from 1980 to my death, hopefully, which is in 2025, or I guess it still could be 2024. But I imagine that, from 1980, it's, very, very minimal. And then somewhere around the lifetime of the Switch, it just goes exponentially up. Because with the availability of buying things digitally, it becomes almost like not a whim purchase, but if something costs like $10, like Shantae and the Pirate's Curse, I'm like, what? For $9, I'll buy that. Sure. And like you said, Jeremy, I have more games now that I could ever possibly play. I mean, if I sat down when I retire someday and I go through and play them, maybe I'll finish 50% of them. But the reality is games are too long and they take too much time and they're too easy to just bounce off of very quickly. Like, I'm guessing, Stuart, did you finish Astrobot or did you say, I'm done with this?
I'm up to like the second level of World 2 and I kept falling asleep like in the chair. I'm not even joking. I would wake up and I'd still be on level 2 too, and I'd be like, oh my God. But I agree. I mean, I have so many... the number of games I have on Steam is, like, just absurd. Yeah. And it comes from things like bundles, which completely devalue the... I mean, I'm grateful that they exist, obviously, but I think if I tallied up the number of games I've bought or installed on Steam versus the number of games I've actually played for any significant amount of time, it would be, frankly, an embarrassing percentage, like 1, probably. 1%. And, like, half of that 1% is just Dark Souls and its sequels. So, I don't know, like... It's similar with Nintendo, but it's the whole thing of having any kind of disposable income and having these incredibly deep sales, which are just the complete opposite of how it was when I was younger. I mean, and also the ease of like returns on Steam digitally just make everything just so, yeah, I'll get that. Yeah, I'll give that a go. And then before you know it, I'm gesturing to the current state I'm in. You can't see it, but that's what happens before you know it.
Yeah, I mean, I look around and part of it is, you know, to your point, Jeremy, of how you're mostly a digital person. So growing up, my mother was a librarian. And so I have this innate sort of, I like to display what I have absorbed, right? There's part of me that feels like I have to have trophies of what I've accomplished. And so there, I'm torn between purchasing the games that I really want to show off and say, look, I enjoyed that. I want to reward, you know, the developers and all the folks that poured their time into this. Even if I might get it on Game Pass, I still want to purchase the games I really enjoyed to say, thank you. Here's your, well, whatever cut of the $60 you actually get. You know, please do a good job and continue to make video games. But you're right. I mean, I look at my Switch. I'm not going to buy a physical copy of, even if I could, of Iron Meat. Great game, but I don't need to spend, you know, $50 on buying a collector's edition of it or something like that.
Yeah, and I don't mean to sound like I'm poo-pooing the idea of owning video games, because I think it's great to be able to do that. And my livelihood depends on people buying games from my employer. So I hope they continue to do that. And I enjoy creating stuff that goes in those packages. It's a lot of fun. It's just, you know, I've been making my living from video games for more than 20 years. And at this point, it's a little, it's, you know, like you work in a sausage factory for a long time. And after a while, you're like, you know what? I don't necessarily need to eat any more sausages. I'm not comparing video games to sausages, but actually I am. Some sausages, very tasty. A little andouille pepper, and yeah, it's good. But yeah, I also do the thing where even if I know that I'm going to be unable to play a game, I still will sometimes buy it just to support it. Like, you know, the most recent Saga remake and the Dragon Quest remakes. Will I ever have time to play those? I don't know. But I decided to purchase those games. I gave, like, you know, 20 cents to Akitoshi Kawazu, and that was my way of saying, please keep making these weird-ass RPGs.
Jeff, what you said about sort of trophies I thought was interesting, because it's like, going by what you said as well, Jeremy, I think sometimes you get those games that are just kind of like a part of you. You know, that's a really silly, like, florid way of saying it, I suppose, but you want to own them because they're important. Even if you never get around to playing them, like these remakes of games that you love and things like that. I mean, for me, it was like, I mean, during the whole COVID, I was buying a lot of like Mega Drive and Game Boy cartridges because for some reason they were very comforting at the time.
Wait, are you the reason the prices went up on those?
Damn. No. That was YouTubers. Monster. That was YouTubers who did that. That was you.
You have a YouTube channel. You have a YouTube channel.
Yeah, that's true, but I only ever upload like pictures of fish I've done. So I don't know, that's complete nonsense. I don't know why I said that. But it's like these things are very comforting in a sense, that just to have them. Like I want to own these cartridges of these like Mega Drive and Game Boy games I loved, even if they're not great games, because then you do have them. They are yours. And yes, you can emulate them at any point, but that's not the same.
Yeah, I mean, the downside is, like, if you have a favorite book, I mean, if you've loved The Great Gatsby and you've got it on your shelf, you could always open it and find your favorite passage. With a video game, it's a little difficult to pry it open and get any real sense of trying to explain to somebody, well, look, this particular chipset here, this is the part that I really enjoyed. But no, you're right. I love the fact, and that sets aside even, like, the box art, you know, the joy of having box art and the joy of, you know, someone... A friend of mine who he and I grew up together, and we exchange Christmas gifts every year from across the country. You know, by the time this episode drops, hopefully he'll have received it. But you know, I bought him kind of several framed pictures of various SNES box art, because you know, Contra 3 and Ninja Turtles, you know, Turtles in Time, those are phenomenal pieces of art that anyone over our age is probably going to say, "What?" I mean, it's going to be a real. You know, seeing a bunch of burly guys hanging on to rockets and shooting aliens, it means something to us, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything to my dad, which is fine. there's a certain, and I guess it goes back to the idea of buying a physical box in a store. There's a certain joy of seeing, like, oh my God, there it is. Like, it's physically there behind that plexiglass, or depending on the store, right there on the shelf. So yeah, there's a certain joy that you don't get from buying digital games. And now it sounds like I'm old man yelling at Cloud, but what can I say?
Cloud's kind of a jerk.
It's true.
Diamond, you were going to say something. You got to just jump in like Akuma's first appearance and just start punching people.
I don't want to punch Jeff. He gives us money. But
that's true. It's fair.
I wouldn't want to punch him anyway.
What? When did this happen?
But no, I think there's been some discourse recently about buying books and buying too many books and having books sitting around your house. And the idea of, you know, why do you keep buying books if you're not going to read them all? And like, oh, you don't need to read every book you buy. It's okay to have these books around just to have these books around. And I sort of feel like that makes sense to me because, yeah, also I buy a lot of books. But also I buy a lot of games that I hope to play someday and I might not actually play them. You know, the last couple of years I've had the privilege to go to some of these game shows, you know, with the other Retronauts folks. And when I go to these shows, I walk around the vendor floors, and yeah, a lot of them are very expensive. I'm not going to drop a lot of money on an expensive game because I'm some sort of like treasure hunter. But you know, when I see a game, when I see a big plastic bin and it's like says, oh, 4 for $20, I'm going to look in that bin. And if I find two or three games that I've known about, I'll probably look and just find a fourth one and say, hey, I got the set. You know, and that's why I have a copy of Narc for Xbox. You know, it's like, do I want to play that game? Not really. And we did a whole podcast to explain why I don't want to play that game. But I have a copy of it, and it's kind of funny to have it here and, you know, have the big, you know, good friend price, $19.95, stare at me back. It amuses me to see that.
Yeah, it's convenient in a sense for me because the things that generally interest me or that I want to own aren't really necessarily the big time games. You can pretty much get those anytime, really, but when you stumble across some old shite like Clash of the Titans on PS3 or something I like Alpha Chicken that is not valuable at all, it's been pretty easy to get hold of a bunch of stuff that I've really loved. You sometimes pay a little bit more for the stuff that's important to you but is also rare in some way. But I think the most I ever spent on like a Mega Drive game was like £60 or something, which is about what it would have cost new, if not slightly less. But that was for The Adventures of Batman and Robin, because I just really wanted to see those crazy effects on the actual Mega Drive, you know, to see if it was real or not, and not just a long prank that's been played by the emulation community.
I have mostly spent prodigious amounts of money on games that I have no real interest in that I need to make videos or books about, and some of that stuff is like super rare and super expensive, and there's no other way to get my hands on it. So I think that's been a big part for me of just saying, step back. But I will say that the advent of proxy shopping from Japanese sites and the aforementioned excellent dollar-to-yen ratio right now and over the past few years has been a great boon for that. If we went back to like dollar, yen, or I guess penny yen parity, that would have to slow way, way down. Although I'm sure Diamond would love it because... No, actually, you get money from foreign sources quite often. Legally, I should stress, that was not as shady as it sounds. So yes, we'll try to keep juicing the US economy, but it may be out of our hands at this point.
I think it was you who taught me about the proxy sites, so cheers for that, Jeremy. There's a lot of Game Boy games specifically that you can get just loose cartridges off for just like quite literally $1 or $2 that are really rare games in English. But the games are in English anyway. It's the same game. It just has a different label on it. Like, what the hell? I got all the Rockman World games. They cost £1,000. Over here, but from Japan they're nothing. It's great. Everyone should do it, except if they did, I wouldn't be able to do it anymore. So please forget everything you just heard.
Yes, I didn't say anything about proxy bidding. You were never here. You remember nothing. So let me ask, I guess we will do the traditional thing. What is your first memory of game shopping? And did you buy a video game as you were game shopping? This may be too far into the past for you to recall. So I will get the ball rolling. The oldest memory I have of home video games being available for sale was not actually at a department store or a toy store. It was at the mall. The South Plains Mall in Lubbock, Texas. And it was an electronics shop where it was basically one of those kind of small mall stores that didn't have a front to it. It was basically just a long room that went from the corridor to, you know, some sort of door at the back where the employees went into mysteriously. But the place was just lined with stereo components and speakers and probably some early computers, and they had an Atari 2600 and were showing it off. And it was very exciting, but it was still kind of the days where stores like that existed, and people didn't necessarily say, video games, we should put that in the toy shop. So that was the early memory. I was probably like 5 years old and therefore did not buy anything. An Atari 2600 was a little out of my price range an allowance of a dollar a month or whatever I had. So, had to forego that. But, I do remember, I think the first video game I actually bought with my own money was probably 5 years later. And it was by mail order because the video games industry had plummeted and crashed by that point. And so, everything was being cleared out and we bought a mail order copy of Donkey Kong for Coleco Adam by mail. And it was very exciting when that just showed up in the mail. It was like in a tiny little box that looked like an arcade machine, and inside was a tape cassette, and it took a long time to load, but it was worth it because Donkey Kong, or Donkey Kong Jr., actually. Jeff, do you have comparable memories or wildly different memories? Let's hear it.
No, it's actually a couple of things you said there kind of, I guess, provoked memories. The one thing just kind of initially, as you're saying, is it feels like at least in the late 80s. I mean, yeah, so I got an NES for Christmas in 1989. So at least I can date myself and say that I don't recall buying video games before that. But I mean, the kind of unique thing was, at least in that era, prior to kind of, you know, Toys R Us or something like that, you could buy video games in the weirdest places, right? They felt like you could buy them at like a department store. You could buy them in small little computer stores in the mall. You could buy them at, you know, drugstore. It was really kind of almost like the Wild West in terms of where you could find games. And for me, my earliest memory was actually buying Mega Man 2 at a garage sale, because that was one of those things where, you know, at least growing up here in the Midwest, Thursday was kind of garage sale day. And my mom, she was a teacher during the year, so she had my sister and I in the summertime, and it was kind of a constant stream of how do I entertain these two children so they don't drive me nuts all day long. And we would go around to the local garage sales, and someone had, at that point, you know, old NES games, and one of which was Mega Man 2. And I remember buying it and playing it, and at that point realizing, oh, well, there must be a Mega Man 1 or whatever the case was. And so after that, going to Toys R Us and just seeing the walls of games, which again, you know, for someone, you know, as a 10-year-old kid or a 9-year-old kid, just seeing the endless amounts of there are this many games for the NES and all the pictures of the box art and taking the ticket out and going up to the counter to buy it. But yeah, Mega Man 2 at a garage sale, you know, the first Castlevania was somewhere around that time. But yeah, it was very much a big box toy store to buy games. So
was sorry about him. Was that Toys R Us? Was that when you had the laminated box art prints that were hanging on the shelves, and
yes,
then they'd go and get them out of? Okay, yeah, we had that as well. I just wasn't
one.
Sure. Okay,
and it was always strange because as a kid, you know, sometimes they would take. The actual, like, take a box and, like, press it, you know, take the game out, press it, and stick it in the laminated sheet so that way you could see it. And sometimes they would, like, have someone, probably some poor employee, draw it. Like, say if they had, like, multiple copies of Mario Brothers 3. Wow. And so you would see it and think, is this, if I pull this ticket, is this the actual game? Or am I getting, like, because there wasn't a way to know. And if you're 10, it's like, my parents have no clue what I'm buying. It's not like buying a record. That's the closest approximation they could think of. So it felt like, is this legit or is this someone's like knockoff bootleg copy of Mario 3? You know, it was a very strange system. Yeah. Yeah.
I remember being when I was a kid and I wasn't buying those games, but I remember just thinking like, well, why are these games so thin? How do they fit the game in there? I didn't get it.
Yeah. And, you know, much like Jeremy said, you know, I had an allowance, you know, growing up, but it really was a kind of back to our point from earlier. It wasn't like I could buy, like, you know, on this podcast alone, Diamond bought two games, you know, at the beginning of the outset of the show. Buying two games within, you know, months of each other was unheard of for little Jeff. That would have blown my mind that I would, you know, be able to purchase multiple games at a time. It just was unheard of.
I'd get like, you know, I know it's the same for most, but I'd get a game on my birthday too if I'm lucky. Christmas, yep. Same deal, nothing else in between. My uncle used to get games from because I had a Master System so much later than everyone else did. I was stuck with the Master System, so as if I didn't enjoy it. But you know, when games did start to get cheaper for the Master System because it was outmoded, I'd sometimes get a couple from I don't know, from like a market or something, like a, you know, like a car boot sale. And I remember how excited I was just getting. At one point, my uncle gave me three games. At the same time, I remember exactly what they were: Shinobi, Running Battle, and RoboCop versus the Terminator. That's two bangers and one piece of shit that I played the hell out of anyway.
You gotta make us guess which one is which.
Running Battle is the piece of shit. It's absolute garbage. The other two are amazing. But yeah, if you don't mind me sort of chiming in, for me the earliest memory was. I don't remember where it was. It was just some shop. It may have been somewhere like a video rental place that was doing X rental stuff because that's the only way I could afford these things at the time. And I got together, I think, about £21, which is not a lot of money. It was more than. And I was allowed to choose one. And I remember I was supervised because I wasn't allowed to get anything that was violent. And I really wanted to get Rastan, you know, the Namco, the game, because the Master System version of that is supposed to be really good. And it was very highly rated in Sega Power, the best magazine ever made. So I was like, yeah, I want that. And because John Rastan is holding like an axe on the cover, like a battle axe, my mom's like, no, you can't have that. It's too violent. So I was like, okay. And I ended up buying James Pond 2, codenamed Robocod, and I think that's where it all went wrong. in reality, what it was I was looking at the games, and I'd seen that, and I thought, oh, that got quite a lot of praise. Let's look at the back. And on the back of Master System games, it usually says, like, how many levels they've got. Like, it says, like, rounds, and it'll be like, because it's the Master System, it'll be like 6 or like 7. And on this one, it's like levels 44. I'm like, what? Like, I've never heard of that many levels in my entire life. How can it possibly be true? And you know, I got that, and I wasn't disappointed. It's a game that fits the 8-bit really, really well. It's very simplistic, but there's plenty of secret and stuff to find. And for me, that was, that was it. That was probably the catalyst for everything, all the appalling things I've said and done since.
James Bond 2. Yeah.
What a butterfly effect moment.
Yeah, it was.
How different would your life have been if you had bought Rastan instead?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I'd have found out some things about myself a lot earlier than I did.
Like you were born to be a bodybuilder?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I've built a body all right.
I guess it's, and I know, Dan, we haven't gotten to you yet, but it, you raise an interesting point, which is especially, at least in that era for me, when I was, you know, 10, 11 years old, going to Toys R Us to buy games, you know, I always went in effectively knowing what I wanted to buy, because it was like, for a kid, especially in like, you know, 1990, 1991, you know, if a game cost $49, or I forget what the average price would have been for a Nintendo or NES or Super Nintendo game. Like, it wasn't like I could go in and buy something on a whim. Like, I had to kind of know effectively, okay, I am here to buy Jurassic Park. That is what I am buying. The world has told me so. I love dinosaurs. This is happening. But it wasn't, I could, you know, unless it was a garage sale where you could, like you said, there are four games essentially for sale. Like, eh, for $10, sure, I'll buy them. Who knows? But it wasn't an impulse purchase. It was really a, I am here on a defined mission. I am buying, you know, whatever it is. You know, I'm buying Contra 3. It is happening. And I left with it. That was it. There was no, like, screwing around. Unlike a digital store where I could flip for hours and say, Balatro, everyone says it's good. Maybe I should buy it. I don't know.
In the pre-Jeremy has a job days, I usually, you know, would go in informed with having been intoxicated by hype from Nintendo Power and maybe flipping through the pages of EGM or GamePro, and would have a pretty good idea of what I wanted, but I still wanted to browse and say, maybe there's something even better here. And that did result in some near misses, like when I really wanted Castlevania back in, I want to say 1988, and it was totally out of production and they hadn't reprinted it yet. And I kept going to like Toys R Us's and they'd have the card, but never the tag. And it was just not available for sale anywhere. And I remember being tempted by the game Athena because it had a silver box, just like Castlevania. And the cover art was pretty cool, like the sort of, you know, Toulouse-Lautrec inspired fantasy painting of the goddess Athena fighting Medusa and stuff like that. Pretty rad. Medusa was also in Castlevania.
Yeah.
So it could be sort of a similar game. But ultimately, I decided, no, I can only afford one game. I got to hold out for Castlevania. So I did not buy Athena. That would have been disastrous. Imagine if I had bought Athena instead of Castlevania. I would not be here because I would no longer like video games. It would be just discouraging. So eventually I did find Castlevania. They reprinted it, but they reprinted it at the same time that Metal Gear came out. So I bought that instead. Womp, womp, womp.
Yeah, I definitely went through different phases as far as game buying goes. I think at the earliest stages, I don't remember being part of the game buying conversation at all. I was too young to ask for the Atari. I think my parents must have bought that for themselves, and then I grew up, like, grew into it, and then they would get me games. But I don't think I ever, like, was directing them to buy games. At least I don't think so. But certainly a few years later when we had a Commodore 64, again, I didn't ask for that, but they bought it, and they probably thought I'd use it for homework, but no, it was mostly games. And I do remember being part of those shopping encounters. I do remember going to Manhattan with probably my father and going to some kind of electronics store and looking around. And I think because I had played Ultima 2 or 3 with a friend of mine, I saw Ultima 4 and I was like, oh, this is good. Let's get this. And it probably turned into like a Hanukkah present or something. And, you know, that game took over my life for a solid year. So I would say, you know, good choice there, young me. But a few years after that, when it became sort of NES time, by that point, my parents had decided they didn't want to buy me video games anymore. They were out of the conversation. So I kind of had to buy all my video games at that point, which means everything was sort of well thought out, well planned, and well saved, unless crazy things happened. And as Jeff mentioned, some games were just being sold all over the place. So when we were in ShopRite, our local supermarket of all things, one day, and I saw a copy of Super Mario Bros. 3 behind the counter, I was like, Mom, you don't understand. That's Super Mario Bros. 3. You can't even find that anywhere else. We got to get it today. It'll be gone tomorrow.
I got to find the warp whistle.
And yeah, somehow I convinced her to give me like an extra month of allowance. I don't know what I did. I must have sold a used cars in a past life, but somehow payday I got loans. That Mario 3. But yeah, I went through a lot of phases like that where, yeah, at young age, I had to buy my games, which means I had to plan out the buying of the games. And most of the time it worked out pretty well. Every once in a while, I'd get sort of a weird gift from like my grandma, or I'd get money from grandma and decide to go shopping for a game, and I'd buy a game that wasn't so good. Like, you know, Ikari Wars for NES is not a great port, but, you know, if you play it enough, you'll convince yourself it's got merit. So I convinced myself. It's fine.
Well done on that. That's a real accomplishment, actually.
But then, as it's funny, as I got a little bit older and I started, you know, working and I had some income, it's funny how games sort of snapped back a little bit and they sort of retreated into sort of the more traditional game stores, which meant I sort of had to seek them out. But thankfully at that point, I also had either friends who drove cars or eventually I drove the car. And then it became more of a, oh, let's go shopping and hang out and have a burrito somewhere and let's see what games are out. And then we'll think about, oh, is there something new? Is there something new? And it sort of became a mix of shopping for things I know exist and shopping and just seeing what's out there. And, you know, sometimes you just find happy accidents, you know, certainly in the days of early consoles, you know, a new console comes out. Maybe you don't know all the games that are there. You know, you go to the PlayStation shelf. Like, I don't know what all these games are. You kind of take a guess. But it's funny how that evolved. And now at this point, it literally could be something like I can go on Steam and see what my friends are buying, see what's on the front page, see what just came out today. And it's like, oh, does this game have a funny name? Does it cost less than $3? Maybe I'll just buy it. And that's the end of the transaction.
Yeah, well, the element of risk is almost completely eliminated, especially when you're a kid and you have so little disposable income. You really can't afford to buy a stinker. Otherwise, you end up like I did. I remember being in, I think, Electronics Boutique, watching some kid hand over what are clearly pound coins, like, to buy, I think it was Bubsy. And I'm like, should I do something? Should I stop this? I mean, I've come around to becoming quite fond of Bubsy in the intervening years, but you just kind of want to stop that, don't you? I don't know. It's with Easy Refunds, and even back with what was Game in the UK, which is about to disappear, the game store, just called Game, when it was big, they had this 10-day, I think it was literally 10-day, air quotes, no quibble, money back guarantee, and I just abused the shit out of that. You know, but that 10 days is enough to beat any old game. Like, you just buy the game and beat it and return it. And eventually they got rid of that policy, and I think that was because of me. So sorry about that.
So, you know, I began shopping for video games, say, 1988 or so, around the time the NES really took off in the US. And I got my own NES. And I noticed that there was a change in retail and how they treated video games around that time from the way it had been during the Atari era. And I'm sure part of that is because so many retailers took a bath on Atari stuff. Like, I remember demoing Pitfall for the first time, you know, back when it was new, at a grocery store. They just had an Atari system set up and a bunch of games next to it with a TV. And there was just a Pitfall cartridge plugged in, and you could walk past and play it and then go and buy Pitfall. Did people go to the grocery store to buy Atari games? No. And I'm sure they lost money and said, we'll never do that again, until they got like a rental section. But you weren't buying, you were just renting. But once the NES came out, all of a sudden video game retailers, you know, whether it was toy stores or department stores, Walmart, whatever, made video games less accessible as packaged products. They started putting them behind counters, behind glass. There was some of that in the Atari days, I remember, but a lot of times you would just walk past a kiosk of games or a display and they would just be the cartridges, you know, the packages, just out there, and you could pick them up, browse them, look at them. And it became much more difficult to do that once the NES sort of took off, and, you know, like Walmart started putting its games back in glass cases, and you had toys, KB Toys, with the wall of games behind the registers. So you always had to find someone or ask someone who worked for this at the store, like, hey, can I look at this game? And it was a little easier back then because stores actually had enough employees on the clock at any given time that you could find someone to help you, as opposed to now where it's like, is anyone here? But it was still inconvenient. And so, you know, the Toys R Us tags were an attempt to remedy that. You could flip over the plastic card and look at it. But that didn't do you much good for the things that were on the top row if you were like an 8-year-old. Like, you know, hey, mom, can you boost me up there so I can look at that card? So I remember actually doing a lot of game browsing and shopping without actually spending money at the few places that didn't make their game packages inaccessible, places like Walden Software, which took kind of a computer store approach and just continued to leave game, you know, like NES games out on the shelf for you to pick up and look at. And another thing that was actually very conducive to shopping for video games was the advent of rentals, because the rental places would just put out the case and not actually, you know, the game in the case. So it wasn't the full package. So there was less worry about shrinkage if you decided to give yourself a five-finger discount. So the point is, you could go and pick up a game package and read the back of the box, which was always important. Look at the screenshots, get a sense of what it's about. And at rental shops, you could actually pay like $3 and rent it for a couple of days, and then you'd know, is this worth owning? But just the ability to go to someplace like a Hastings or a Blockbuster and pick up the game and not just look at the art, but actually see what it's about on the back. Does it have a battery feature? Is there a password? Or do the screenshots look good? Does this sound like a compelling, interesting plot? Does this look like something that was hacked together? What can I tell from three tiny thumbnails? That made a big difference to kind of my choices. And I would go armed with that knowledge from Walden Software to someplace with better prices and make my purchases that way.
Now, it's funny you mentioned the prices, Jeremy. It was interesting, especially in that era, how prices could vary wildly from store to store. Like, I remember you said Walden Software, which is a, I don't think I've said that combination of words in probably 30 years. But that was the kind of store where a game may cost $49 at Toys R Us, but a Walden Software was $64. You know, it was just kind of a strange, there was no consistency to it. And, you know, having now worked at Best Buy, I understand kind of like it's much more corporate now. I mean, the numbers come down from above. They're set at places. It's not an independent little someone behind the counter with a sticker gun is saying $64 for whatever, or $84 for Chrono Trigger or whatever it was. But that kind of strange lack of overall, you know, star bucking, whatever, to use the term from the world's end of the video game industry. It's everything is, you know, regulated now to as many degree, which is strange. So
I think stores and malls just tend to be more expensive because the mall outlet rent price is higher. So they have to make that up, but they also kind of feel like, well, we've got a captive audience here. Like if you're out there to shop, you're more likely to spend a little more money just to be able to do the one stop pickup thing. I don't know how successful that was, and Walden Software is no longer around, so maybe not that successful. And EB Games is now mostly Funko Land, not like Funko Land, the used game shop, but Funko Pop Land. Confusing, I know, but somehow it brought it all full circle.
Yeah, they're great, aren't they?
The other thing, Diamond, you mentioned this, I think the last, when you were describing your early experiences as well, the idea of going to the mall and seeing what was new and what was out. At least, you know, the idea of release dates is, at least in the early era, release dates were kind of a, who knows when things would come out. And there wasn't a way necessarily, unless, because even, you know, Jeremy, you said Nintendo Power, you know, that would give you the months of buildup to a particular game, but it didn't necessarily tell you when it was going to come out. And as a kid, you had some sense of things come out before Christmas. That's just when things come out, because that's the natural order of the universe, is you want to buy things, your parents look for gifts, etc. But beyond that, you know, the idea of games having defined release dates that a kid, at least in 1990, could know about was kind of a novelty. And so the best you could do would be to call the store and ask them, do you have X, Y, and Z? And it's just like, I feel bad because I'm sure that there are plenty of employees that I drove nuts calling about. Yeah, right. You're waving your hand. Yeah.
I don't think the idea of video games having release dates was even was common until I was basically almost out of high school. You know, like Mortal Monday was a big deal.
And Mortal Monday and Sonic Tuesday were two of the greatest innovations in video games. Yeah, I was about to
mention Sonic Tuesday. Yeah,
like, but before those era, before that time came around, you know, a lot of their, you know, almost everything I bought on Nintendo and most of what I bought on Super Nintendo was just kind of like, let's see what's out there. We've read about this thing. We've heard it's coming out soon. Let's go find it. And then from, you know, N64, PlayStation onward, I had a better sense of when things were coming out and I could sort of expect when I might find something. I remember buying, say, Resident Evil on opening day because I knew it was coming out and I read about it and it sounded good. So I was at the store and I bought it and brought it home. And then my dad called me up and said he needed the car and I had to drive back to the city and give him his car. So I couldn't play it on the day I bought it, which was really frustrating. But, you know, it worked out. I bought I played that game enough. It really happened for me.
A lot of like old listed like game release dates, surely they've got to be at least sort of somewhat apocryphal at this point. Like, is it even concrete when these things?
It's all based on like, you know, corporate shipping labels and when they said they released something to their investors. You know, like I do a lot of writing about game anniversaries, and believe me, most of my sources these days are just like corporate records or someone writing down in a book when they think these games came out. And like, if they wrote it down in a book, it's probably good enough to write down as a column. But well, it's like, you know, if I had a time machine, it would still be a lot of guesswork. You know, I don't know for a fact that, you know, hell, we're recording this in December 2024. We are pretty sure Cave Story came out in December 2004. But when did it come out? You know, different websites at different dates. I guess the guy who made the game has an idea. He recorded a video saying congratulations on 20 years, but does he have the exact date in mind? I don't know if he did. You know, he had like three other games on his website. You know, I don't know if he kept dates.
You should ask Scott Sharkey about that, because he wrote about the game like the weekend it came out. But I would highly recommend for tracking contemporary coverage of video games a newspapers.com subscription. It's like $75 a year, and it's a phenomenal resource for tracking down information on, you know, people writing about video games back when they first came out and getting a really good sense of when the release date was. Because, yeah, the things were very vague back then. There was no structured games industry per se, and they hadn't sort of landed on certain days of the week as the weekly game release day. And so video games were distributed a lot like toys, which is that they shipped from the factory to distributors at a certain time, and then the distributors would pass them along, and the retailers would get them, and, you know, they would put them out and ship them to their different satellite stores whenever it made sense. So, you know, Super Mario Brothers 3 came out at one store 1 week, but then another retail chain wouldn't get it for another month. It was very, very nebulous like that. And I know I've mentioned this before, but at the time, during the NES era, some of my game shopping was made much easier because I had an aunt who worked at the warehouse for Best Products. So she would literally see this stuff when it came off the conveyor belt from the trucks. And she, you know, I would occasionally tell her like, hey, I'm looking for this one game. So she just kind of keep an eye open for it. And when it would come in, she'd grab it. And I would get the employee discount on top of having early access and not have to go, you know, jingle all the way for a copy of a vanishingly hot game like Ninja Gaiden or Super Mario Brothers 3. So that was pretty cool. But then, you know, around the time of the Super NES launch, she took a different job at the hospital. And that did me no damn good whatsoever for getting video games.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the idea of like hunting. I mean, that is something that is lost, I guess, the lost art or the lost joy of like hunting for something that would be impossible to find, right? I mean, nowadays, any game you could download effectively the day it's released, and we know when that's going to happen. But even something like, you know, the Christmas of 1996 when the N64 was released in the West, and I remember very distinctly, you know, February of that year when it was delayed to September. And it was, I remember I got mine at Babbage's, which I'm sure is long since extinct now.
It was absorbed into EB.
Yeah, okay. Yep. Yeah, that sounds about right. But yeah, the idea of, you know, you could go and pre-order it and pay, you know, whatever it was, $250, I think, to get it. And I think that was the first system that I purchased with my own money. It wasn't a gift. It wasn't something that I had, you know, gotten secondhand. And so, you know, going there and pre-ordering it and knowing that on September 26th, I was going to the mall to get my N64. And the, at that point, what, four games that were released for it before the total of six, I think, came out that Christmas. Yeah, well, two, Mario and Pilot Wings, that's right. And the chess game in Japan, but, whatever that was, which I've forgotten.
Before
Cruisin' USA and Shadows of the Empire. But again, you know, it was going around to multiple stores to try and find something was, in some ways, a novelty until it stopped being a novelty and became very frustrating. So,
if the thing you were after wasn't especially popular, they wouldn't even display it a lot of the time. And I've had experience in the UK where, this is a little bit later, but I remember when I went to buy Guitar Man the day it came out because I'd seen it in a magazine and thought, yes, this is extremely jipcore. I'm having that. And I went there and like, hey, can I get this game that just came out today? And they're like, yeah, we don't have it. I was like, great, fantastic, thanks for wasting my time. I didn't actually say that, I was very polite. But then as I walked out, the employee sort of chased me out of the shop and went, oh, we've got one copy, we've ordered in one copy. great, nice. There was something I wanted to ask, actually, which I'm not sure if it's jumping ahead too much, so stop me if it is, but when you went from, you know, air quotes, kid to sort of enthusiast, but prior to sort of the spread of online shopping, did you have, like, import store? Was that a thing? Like, or did you have, like, a dedicated store where you'd be able to find import games, or was that just completely out of your reach until, well, not eBay, but, you know, the internet?
I was very fortunate in that I lived in the outskirts of New York City. Mm-hmm. So even before the internet sort of took over and I would get stuff, you know, from online retailers that were importing things, I could always go to Chinatown and take a look at what was going on in Chinatown. And, you know,
that Elizabeth Street walk. Yep.
Exactly. Exactly. You go down there and there's a bunch of stores. There were a bunch of stores in the same neighborhood. I would sort of patrol them all. And if they had a new game from Japan, they might. If they had a game that was coming out, but, you know, they got it early, they would just put it out. They didn't care about street dates. So there was always kind of a fun, you know, what could possibly be down there feeling that I would get. And it's too bad. Unfortunately, if you go to New York City today, J&L Game is one of those stores that still exists from the sort of Chinatown days. But at this point, you know, with the rising prices and imports and all that, like, if you go in a J&L Game, I don't know if I could afford to buy anything there anymore. Like, everything's just astronomical now. So,
well, and so many more games are being localized than were during like the 16 and 32-bit eras. For myself, you know, living in West Texas, the import scene was not exactly bumping. But I do recall that around the advent of the 32-bit era, there was a shop in Abilene, Texas, where I lived at the time, that was mostly focused on computers, but they also dealt in like some kind of weird CD stuff. Like they had a porn game section. And so they started selling like Super Famicom games and then PlayStation imports and so forth. And, you know, when I got my PlayStation and I saw Symphony of the Night was coming out in Japan and had not been announced for the US, I was like, I've seen that game in motion, and I cannot live without a Castlevania game that looks that good. Once again, it comes back to Castlevania. I did not waver. I did not get Athena. I got Castlevania eventually after playing
good
Metal Gear.
You, Jeremy.
And so I knew 10 years later, I need this game, and they're not going to bring it to America. So I took my new PlayStation in there, and I had a mod chip attached, and I paid a lot of money for Gekka no Nocturne. And
it was like Gex or something.
Yes, it's Gex in Castlevania fighting Dracula. So, you know, I paid way too much money for this, and it was absolutely worth it. And that kind of opened the floodgates. And so I ended up buying a lot of import stuff from them. I think the first time I ever went into the store, they were playing an import copy of Final Fantasy VII. Mm. So it would have been early 1997. And they were they'd made it to Wutai. So they were doing pretty well for an import game. And that just kind of stuck with me. And I was like, this is so cool. And they had all these Super Famicom games that cost like $120. And I said, I'm not even doing that. But the PlayStation stuff came in a little more reasonably priced. And that was also around the time that online shopping became much more accessible. And places like Tronix became mainstays. And so I started importing, you know, by mail order. And, you know, around then I got my first full-time job. So all of a sudden I was a single dude living in the very, very inexpensive part of Texas and had a pretty decent amount of liquidity to waste on doing stuff that would ensure the fact that I would remain a single man living in West Texas.
You know, we mentioned 1997. I don't want to let this slip by. If we can flip the podcast on its head for a second and talk about selling games, because 1997 was the year I spent a good chunk of that year in a software, etc. And so I got sort of a taste of how the other half lived, if you will. Mm. And going back to what Jeff said, like when Final Fantasy VII came out, I was the person who had to answer the phone that day. And all day long, basically, I made it part of the answering of the call. It's like, hello, thank you for calling software, etc. Yes, we have Final Fantasy VII, because it was nonstop. And, you know, even saying that, I'd still get people ask me the question, like, yes, we have Final Fantasy VII. Yes, we have Final Fantasy VII. I answered it twice. Yes, thank you very much.
That fascinates me, because Final Fantasy had no footprint prior to that over here. I mean, that was the game that kicked it all off. And I remember just reading CMVG and going, what the hell is Final Fantasy V? What is that? I've never even heard of this. But no, I did work in an import shop for a bit, but it's different for me, I think, and for the UK in general, because for us, you know, we got PAL games, which, as we all know, are garbage. I'm kidding.
But not. The colors are so good.
Yes, they're true. But American import games, for us as well, was a big deal, because you got everything so much earlier at that, you know, all the way up through to like the DS. And there's a lot of good Nintendo stuff that never came out over here. So when I found out about certain stores would get in things like GBA games, well, super early, DS games super early, or Japanese DS games, since they're all region free anyway, I'd be all over that. I remember the first Japanese game I bought ever. It was Jump Superstars for the DS. A good one. Quite frank, I had to get Ultimate Stars as well, but even things like Animal Crossing coming in early on the DS, and making my then girlfriend incredibly jealous because I had WarioWare Twisted, because that didn't come out in the UK at all. They just didn't release it. The prevailing rumor was that it had Mercury in the sensor, but that sounds made up. But it was very cool in the UK, because there was this whole other world. Sometimes you'd be unlucky and the game would eventually come out, but in vanishingly rare quantities. But I remember importing things like that Contra 4 and like Mega Man ZX, because you just didn't know. There was someone popular at the time that you just didn't know. But in that import shop, which was called Gametron Exchange and is now gone, may its ashes burn forever, I remember for the first time playing on a 60 hertz console. On the PS2, I think it was, playing Mark of the Wolves, because they had that in. And I'm just like, how come this feels so good? What is it about this that just suddenly feels so fast and slick and fluid? And I think that's how I found out just how bad we'd had it at the time.
Around the same time that all of this was happening, a little site called eBay came into being. And I remember stumbling across that. It's basically where you go and sell stuff and you think you've made a lot of money, but then eBay keeps a lot of fees. And so you realize you've taken a horrible loss on everything you sell. It's pretty cool. I highly recommend it.
Do they sell bootleg GBA games that I kept buying?
The first thing I bought on there was a bootleg copy of Rockman Dash, aka Mega Man Legends, because that was another one I wasn't sure it was going to come out in the US. I was like, well, I should buy this import copy. This one here on eBay seems very inexpensive. I bet I can win this auction. And I did win the auction. And I know I've told this story here too, but when it arrived, I was very upset that it came as a CDR. And I looked back at the auction that I won for like $30, and it said Hong Kong silver on the auction listing. And I contacted the buyer. He was like, yeah, it's a Hong Kong silver. It's a bootleg from Hong Kong. I was like, thanks for nothing, asshole. Like, how am I supposed to know that? So I think it was, you know, kind of meant to be for people who were in the know already, and I was not in the know. And so I learned an important lesson that day, but I still have that bootleg CD around. So if I ever want to play Rockman Dash, I can play it illegally from an authentically illegal format, as opposed to just downloading the ROM.
I don't think I could get anywhere in that game in Japanese. I can barely get anywhere in English.
Yeah, eBay, it's funny how eBay landed at the perfect time for me, which is to say almost the worst time for me, because I had, you know, I was working at the post office back then, which means I had an incredible amount of disposable income. So I could go on eBay and buy all sorts of things that I absolutely did not need, and indeed were turned out to be crap when I finally got them. But definitely, I was able to get a lot of video games in those early eBay days for what are probably now comparatively cheap prices. At the time, they just seemed like good prices. Today, they're probably, you know, incredibly cheap prices. But it was kind of a crazy experience because, yeah, you sort of had to deal with, you know, a lot of unknown factors. Like, who is this? You know, it's a name on a screen. There's a number indicating that they're, you know, they have a reputation, but you still don't know what's going to happen. I think every time I tried to buy something, me and my friends would joke because, you know, we were the kind of people who, like, we bought, you know, we'd win the auction, we'd contact the seller right away, and we'd look for results right away. And we would keep getting, like, people just emailing us, like, excuses. And, like, each time the excuses just seemed more and more uncommon. Like, oh, I got in a car accident. Oh, I couldn't get the post office this week. My mom is sick or whatever. And we're just like, okay, look, just tell us you're busy. It's like, I refuse to believe we keep getting caught with this many people with bad luck. I think you just, you know what, you don't have time, then just tell us you don't have time. You know, it's like, we're not cops.
I was going to say, it's like Ellie Yankovic said, it's a worldwide garage sale, right? I mean, it's just basically, but the downside is, at least when I bought Mega Man 2 at a garage sale, whether the game worked or not, I had it in my hand. Like, it was, you know, and at that point in time in 1990, people hadn't been screwing around trying to pull pieces out of it and replace it with something else. But no, Diamond, to your point, so you worked at a software, et cetera. I worked at Best Buy. When I was in law school, this would have been the fall of 2005. If you went through Coralville, Iowa to store 21, you would have found me working in the media section, which was DVDs, CDs, which don't exist anymore, and video games. And
Best Buy also does not sell movies anymore.
I know. Some of my friends who still work in the industry tell me that. I'm like, well, my entire section basically ceases to exist. Which,
what the heck do they even sell there? What else is there? Good Lord.
Washing machines.
I was going to say refrigerators, washing machines, high-end TVs. Well, I wouldn't say super high-end, but, you know, decent TVs. But no, I mean, to your point about answering the phone, I didn't have to answer the phone. That wasn't part of my, you know, I was kind of stocking shelves and keeping track. And, you know, I did probably a handful of times have the sort of the story of the grandmother coming in to ask about, oh, I'm buying a game for my, you know, my grandson for Christmas. What should I buy? You know, and, you know, it's noteworthy because really, you know, two things. One, that was the summer and the fall when the hot coffee mod came out for Grand Theft Auto. And so I remember very distinctly coming into work that day. And there, you know, we had like a team meeting beforehand, and they said, look, we have to pull all the copies of this game off the shelf because it's now rated adults only, which means that Best Buy won't sell it. And so it's like, okay, whatever. And I remember even as someone who, you know, had a passing knowledge of how games worked, it's like, well, I don't see how that's going to make a difference for the PlayStation 2 copies. But, all right, fine, we'll pull it off. It doesn't really make a difference. I'll do whatever you say. And then a week later, we put them right back because it didn't make a huge difference.
Sound and fury.
Correct. Yeah. You know, we have to respond before people complain about it. But the other noteworthy thing was that was the fall that the Xbox 360 was released. And I remember that we had a display in the store, which I think, you know, Jeremy, you mentioned. I mean, the one thing that without having a physical location to go purchase video games, you do lose kind of the joy of having the display that's set up that you can just walk up and say, like, what is this? And, you know, again, I have memories of going into Toys R Us and seeing the N64 for the first time and thinking, so this is how it's going to work. This is how the controller feels. This is how Mario running in 3D spaces is going to work. And with the 360 release, we had a 360 in the store. I think it was the higher end model, because they released like the arcade version that didn't have memory or some type of, didn't have a hard drive or something like that.
Yeah.
Which was, was fun explaining to people, well, you're not buying a hard drive, understand that you're getting it with just RAM, which is not going to hold much. But the game that they chose to display with it was King Kong, which was like based on the Peter Jackson 2005 movie, which again, I don't remember. I remember the movie. I remember that was his blank check film after Return of the King, kind of like, I guess, The Odyssey for Christopher Nolan now. But the game itself, I suppose, was like a graphical, like, hey, look at this. It's incredible. I just remember being very, very foggy and people being kind of mystified, like, this, what is this? It's like, oh, it's the new Xbox. Okay, shrug. You know, it didn't really Jeez. Register. So.
But you could also buy the HD DVD add-on and That's watch right. King Kong as you play King Kong on the same system, just get the full King Kong experience. But King Kong did stand out because it was an easy, maybe the first game to give you like a super easy 1,000 gamer score. So people liked it for that. And then I probably would return it after the hour it took them to get the gamer score maxed out.
Wow.
Yep.
I was just thinking about GameTron and working there and how much of an absolute DOS job it was, because they were so slack with everything, and I'm sure that they were breaking innumerable laws, tax laws. I'm not going to allege that, like, seriously, because the guy might hear this and somehow and find out who I am and come after me, which I've feared ever since I left, to be honest.
Well, but, thankfully, you don't use your real name on these podcasts.
Oh God, yes, absolutely. But I remember just like the way that they would sell stuff, like. Someone coming in to buy a DS with New Super Mario Brothers when that was huge, and we didn't have New Super Mario Brothers, we didn't have any copies, and the boss is like, run to game and buy a new copy of New Super Mario Brothers, and then run back here and we will sell that. And I was like, okay. And he's like, it's $24.99, go buy it. And I went, and it's not $24.99. No games are $24.99. It's $30. So whatever, doesn't matter. It's this or no sale. So you buy it, take it back. And then the guy is mad at me because it wasn't the price that he made up in his head. Just a dangerous, dangerous man. And it's the difference between a sale and no sale. And yet I'm still slightly salty about that. What I'm really salty about is the price of retro games back then compared to what they are now, because if I think about the stuff I've bought and sold in the meantime and the mansion that I could be living in right now, it's
oh, yeah. I thought I had totally scored in 2001 when I flipped the copy of Panzer Dragoon Saga that I bought for $50 and made than $200 off of it. That was an incredible return. Boy, do I wish I had kept that. Likewise, you know, one of the fun things about gaming retail was there would just be bargain bins and just piles of leftover games. And usually it was absolute garbage, but sometimes you could find really cool stuff in there. Like, I really wish when I went to Target that one time and they had about 10 copies of Castlevania Legends for $20 that I had bought all of them, put them in a box and sold them piecemeal, one by one, sealed and mint here in the year 2024, because I would also be, if not in a mansion, I would at least not have any credit card debt. So that would be pretty sweet. I think lots of people saw the Earthbound markdowns where they were like $15 or $20 for complete copies of Earthbound. There was a Kmart near me that definitely had an entire, it was like a hopper. It was like a huge wire bin, and there must have been at least 30 copies of that game in there just marked down for super cheap, but I already had it, so I was like, why would I need this? If only I had known that each one of those games sealed in the present day would be worth, sealed copy of Earthbound, probably $6,000, eight, I don't know, 10.
I try not to think about it. You could get those,
one of those, you know, put on those grading sites and auction it off for basically a new car. And I didn't do that. So I'm full of regret for having gone to stores and not said, ooh, in the future, this would be a great thing to have and store it away for 25 years.
There was the period where, sort of in the UK, we had the shop GameStation, which was like the rival to Game, but the difference was they sold used stuff going way back to, well, old retro systems, really. But they didn't actually know what anything was worth to burn even the... I don't know what you'd call it, like the broadest sort of strokes. And it was in those days that I'd like, you could go in and buy, I remember very vividly, a wall of Neo Geo Pocket color games complete in their UK sort of clamshell boxes that they had, which were fantastic boxes, by the way. If you haven't seen them, we probably have. And it was like, oh, Metal Slug Pocket and Metal Slug Second Mission, I'll take those. Oh, it's Neo Geo, what's it called? Match of the Millennium, both versions of Car Fighters. Yeah, why not? Oh, they're all buy one, get one free, and they're all £2. Yes, I'll take all of these, thank you. And then later I'd sell them for like, I don't know, like 40 for Metal Slug 2. And I'm just kind of like, wow, I made like £20 there, amazing. I'm a genius. And then I look at what they're worth now and I just sort of try not to think about it, really. It's the same thing with my old PS1 collection. Got rid of the lot, all my N64 games, got rid of all of them, needed the space. They were worth a fair amount, you know, at that time. I was like, ooh, I can get £90 for Symphony of the Night. I'm going to sell that right now. And now it's worth something like 400. So that's fun. That's nice.
Is it?
To think
wow.
About.
Wow.
Yeah, I think so. That's what they sell it back for anyway. It is crazy. It's ludicrous. And we talked about it on the YouTube episode, obviously, how it's pushing prices up and like this kind of coverage. So yeah, thanks for that, Jeremy. Thanks for doing
sure.
that.
Sure. I don't remember being on that episode, but I'm glad that I was.
I think we talked about that.
We did.
Yeah, okay, good.
Yeah, so one thing I do want to mention that I think really changed the nature of shopping for games was the advent of pre-orders, which was something that existed in a very sort of loose form throughout the 90s, but I feel like it really started to solidify, you know, once Babbage's and EB started to kind of consolidate their grip on the market. And I do remember, I'm trying to think, the first game that I pre-ordered might have been Chrono Trigger for Super NES, which I got as a trade-in. I traded in Final Fantasy III for Chrono Trigger, and it shaved like $20 off the price. Not worth it in the end. I should have just paid the full price for it. But yeah, I was in college. What can you do? You don't have any money then. But yeah, I would kind of got on the pre-order train early. I pre-ordered a Nintendo 64, and then a bunch of PlayStation 1 games, and I got to be pretty good buddies with the guys at Babbage's, which, you know, Babbage's was a little more expensive than other shops, but they would let me pre-order, and they had, like, this very random import section, which is surprising for a mall store in West Texas, but, you know, I picked up a few Saturn games there for, you know, import Saturn titles, just because, like, these are here and extremely cheap. I don't get it, but okay. But yeah, I pre-ordered the PlayStation 2 there like 6 months before it came out. And that turned out to be a really smart move because that game or that system was extremely hard to find for like 6 to 9 months. So, you know, on launch day, I went with everyone else who had pre-ordered the game. They opened early. We got in line at like 5 a.m. The guys from the store came out into the hallway where there were 20 of us dudes waiting for our PlayStation 2s and gave us donuts. It was pretty nice. So, like, you know, it just felt like this little sort of community thing happening. And that sort of went away and it became much more of like, hey, why don't you pre-order this game, put $10 down now, and you can also do all these other things. And it just became monetized. But there was that brief window where it just felt like, hey, this is kind of the insider approach. Like, if you follow games media, if you read the magazines and kind of have a sense of what's coming up, you don't have to worry about going and not being able to find it because you can pre-order it, put a little money down, put, you know, it was, again, very informal. So you could put like a dollar down. I actually prepaid my PlayStation 2 entirely in advance just so I wouldn't have to worry about not being able to afford it when it came out. So I literally just walked in, had a donut, waited in line, took my PlayStation 2 and a copy of Ridge Racer 5 home and paid nothing. Just walked out. It was glorious. But, you know, that eventually went away, but it was like this, you know, made me feel a little like, haha, yeah, I've got the jump on everyone. If only they knew, the suckers. But then they found out and it stopped being fun.
No, you're right. I mean, I also have memories of pre-ordering Chrono Trigger. It's probably the same summer of 1995, somewhere in that range. And same thing with the N64. And you're right. I mean, so much now is very pre-order centric. I mean, the industry is very much let's gauge what the interest in Assassin's Creed 25 is going to be by heavily, heavily marketing the pre-order market. Then we can decide, oh boy, this is going to be a bomb. Let's just move on to the next project because the shareholders need to be rewarded for giving us money. But you're right. I had stopped working at Best Buy by the fall of 2006 when the Wii came out. But I do remember knowing that it was going to be just an absolute, you know, debacle when it did, driving past the mall the morning that it was released and seeing the line of people just, you know, outside the store, down the strip, into the parking lot. And I didn't get one for another year because those, like you said, the PlayStation 3 was tough to find. The Wii was impossible for a solid year. I think I finally got it as a gift because someone in like Minneapolis saw it at a random Toys R Us and then mailed it to me and said, here you go, you know, Merry Christmas. Wow. So, you know, and now as we sit here on the eve of presumably the Switch 2 being announced in the next, whatever, 3 months or so.
It'll be announced, but again, during it's this sort recording. Of like,
that might be aggressive. You know, here's the trailer for the system. Here are the new games. The second this trailer is over, go ahead and just pre-order it immediately, right? It's kind of a, don't bother going to the store. Just go to Amazon, go to Best Buy, pre-order it now, and it'll get shipped to you. And so you do miss some of that drinking coffee and hanging out with folks beforehand, or getting to know the folks behind the counter at the store, or being told, well, you can pre-order a Switch as long as you buy 6 games that you don't really, 2 of which you might want and 4 that you don't, 2 extra controllers, the extra expansion pack or whatever it is, like, yes, the joys of working at software, et cetera, where you have to, what is it, UPT, units per transaction. How many things can we make you purchase in addition to the actual item you want to buy?
I'm very grateful that, I don't know if it's universal or not, but at least the shops that I go to in Japan, they don't seem to charge anything for pre-orders. It's literally like, oh, you want this game? Fill out this information. We'll reserve one for you. And then just come, you know, be sure to come pick it up on the day. Otherwise, we have the right to sell it or whatever. But it's like, you know, I still occasionally pre-order big things that I know are coming, like, say, the Switch when it came out and some of the high-profile Nintendo games for the Switch. I've done that. Whenever they announce whatever the next thing is, I'm certainly going to try and figure out where I can reserve it and when, you know, what it takes. You know, although these days, the way this, the Japanese system works, I may have to resort to a lottery, which will not be fun. But, you know, I might get lucky. I don't know. I got lucky with the OLED model. I did not get lucky with PlayStation 5, not for a long time.
Oh, but, yeah, so the circumstances with the PS5, obviously, with COVID and such, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with the next Switch. I'm worried. I'm also a little bit worried about that. But yeah, it is, I am grateful for the fact that there is still it's still pretty reliable for me to go to a store, write my name down, request a thing, and then when the thing comes out, I just go to the store and I pay them the money and I get the thing. That's still a very fun experience for me. You know, I worked at a mall for a couple of years here in Japan, so that made it even easier because, like, oh, I can literally go during my lunch break and go get that game I want, you know?
It was touched on with the mention of, like, Assassin's Creed, but when pre-ordering moved over from, like, pre-order a system or a physical game and maybe you get some, you know, feelies with it, I remember the Portrait of Ruin being pretty good. Nowadays,
oh, yeah,
when you get things like downloads, digital download games that have pre-orders, or it's like you can play this a few days early, or you get like the soundtrack, I'm just kind of like, what are you doing? Like, How has this ever become a thing? Who allowed this? I remember that my favorite one was, I think it was Deus Ex, Human Revolution. It may have been the one after that, Mankind Divided. Not retro, sorry. Actually, maybe it is retro now. Let us know.
It is, kind of, yeah.
They had this pre-order gauge, which was like the more people pre-order, the more it unlocks like bonuses in the game or something. And it was like, it just crashed. It just tanked terribly. Like, no one liked it. It was like, what do you mean? Of course, this makes no sense. Just give us the stuff. But that sort of goes into all sorts of different sort of topics there. I just think that the effort to transfer the pre-order from something that makes sense into you can download this when it comes out is laughable. Really, really laughable.
You don't want extra coats for your character to wear in Star Wars Outlaws?
Like they're going to run out. Like they're going to run out of downloadable copies, you know, of Care of the Kangaroo. It's not going to happen.
You never know. Those bits, they're a vanishing resource. I mean, for the most part, I don't buy games at retail anymore. I just, you know, like go to Best Buy or whatever, bestbuy.com, and say, well, that's coming out in 6 months to a year. I'll pre-order it. And then I forget and it shows up and I'm like, oh, whoops, I didn't mean to spend that money. Or worse, Best Buy's, their order management and tracking system online is actually shockingly bad. So there are some games I have multiples of just because I forgot that I had pre-ordered it. And I looked at Best Buy's, you know, order info and I didn't see it anywhere. And they don't like the way they sort of manage stuff. They present it on their website is they just give you like a list of orders and the amount of money that you spent on something or that you've committed to, but they don't actually say what it is until you like click through the order. And it just makes it really hard to keep track of, you know, at least Amazon will have the like, hey, you previously purchased this on such and such a date, which is nice. Best Buy, not so much. So it's kind of jaded me, and I've stopped really pre-ordering games, which means I pretty much stopped buying them. But maybe someday
I'll get back. I mean, I would love to buy games at retail in the UK, but where the hell can I? You know, game is going. It's basically been relegated to a tiny part of a Sports Direct shop where you can buy things like shorts and socks. But I could go to CEX, which is the major one in the UK, really. There's one in every city now, one in every town, pretty much. And that is a secondhand shop. That is a constant, you know, cycle of stock. None of that money is getting back to the developers, I would have thought. None of it's getting back to the publishers, even. It's all things people have played and then traded back in. So that, I mean, it's not really going to last. The games have to come from somewhere, and I guess it's going to have to be online, especially when they're pricing things at such ludicrously high values, because they're just looking at like eBay and going, yes, we should copy that, but slightly increase the number. It's not sustainable. So basically, buying games retail in the UK is essentially a waste of. I mean, I should go to specialist shops, you know, but there aren't enough of those either. It's all just a bunch of nothing.
Yeah, we took a nephew to an EB a few weeks ago so he could buy a birthday gift. Oh. It does still exist, but it's basically like a closet now full of toys. There's an entire VR section that's just like headsets and things and gift cards. And then they have like two segments of a wall that have physical games for current consoles, but and not even Switch. It was all just like PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series. So There's not a lot of magic there. If you want a lot of action figures from Star Wars The Acolyte, the popular Disney Plus show, they have those in quantity, but Switch games, not so much. You're going to have to really look for those. I really feel like the game shopping experience that once existed, the closest you're going to find these days is small independent stores. Mm-hmm. So we're fortunate in where I live in Raleigh, North Carolina, to have the Limited Run retail shop. And then about an hour away, there's Lost Ark Games in Greensboro. And it's basically like every city has to have, you know, one of these little shops. And it's basically kind of taking things back to the sort of modern iteration of that shop where I bought my first import games, less seedy usually. More family friendly, kind of heavily focused on retro stuff, but usually there's a selection of newer things and used games. Actually, there's like another shop that I just discovered less than a mile from where I live, just up the street, basically. That's right next to a ramen place, and it sells tons of used games and some current stuff. And I'm like, wow, what a great idea. Like, bring in the weeaboo dorks to get ramen. And then while they're waiting in line to get into this place that doesn't take reservations. They go next door and they buy video games. What a racket. Like, clever, very clever. Clever girl.
Obviously, it depends on location. I mean, just to be real specific, in Norwich in the UK, there's a shop called Lost, I think it's called Lost Level Games, or maybe Lost Level Games, and that's very similar. It sells new stuff, but it's also, you know, walls of old cartridges, old DS games, old Atari games and systems even. And because they know no one's going to pay some of the eBay prices because they're stupid, just because Metal Jesus Rocks said something was valuable, you know, they can sell these things and you can go in and maybe you can find a bargain, and that's the magic comes back just for a moment. And it's also nicely run and clean and pleasant. And the guy is nice. And it's not like back in the day when I was buying imports from like a stall where they also sold copied versions of gory, like Japanese pink violence films. You know, it's a very different world. But the only way to recapture any of it is to support these local sort of specialist stores. So please do that. Is the ultimate message I'm going to offer here.
Not to, sound too much like I'm self-promoting, but I will say one thing I like about limited run retail is that the retail business is not the main purpose of the company. And it's just kind of like an extra sort of side project that the CEO wanted to create. And so the used game collection there is actually very affordably priced. Like, it's eBay actual sales prices or less. So it's a really great place to just go and browse. And because they're taking, you know, they accept trades, since I'm sure it's kind of an easy choice for them, because they're selling mostly limited run product, which, you know, like, we manufacture it. So I have to assume that there's a lower cost than wholesale for stocking those things. So they can afford to, you know, take credits for, or, you know, take old games in for credits and still not take a massive loss. I don't know exactly how the retail business works, but every time I go over, it's like the retail retro section has grown and has expanded to encompass more and more stuff. And it's always like, oh, these are prices from 15 years ago. That's nice. I remember when games used to cost this.
That is cool. I'd like to visit. Where is it again? Sorry, just to make it even more of an advert.
Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yeah.
If you're nice, I'll even let you meet me when you're there.
No, that's okay. I just want to go to the shop. I've always wanted, if I was like disgustingly rich, I would open my own game shop where I only accept trade-ins of things I like. I would just be like, I want to sell you this. I'll be like, no, I don't like that. Get out. I would love to do that.
How many empty shelves would there be?
Oh, all of them. Like, all of them would be empty. Anything that comes in that I want, I would just take, you know.
35 copies of James Pond 2, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The game store where no one buys anything except you. Mm-hmm. All games are dust collectors.
It's pretty much just a waste of time and money, yeah.
That's the name. That's the name on the sign.
That's the name of the shop, a waste of time and money.
That would be confusing, though. People might say, oh, it's my YouTube channel. Any final thoughts on buying retro games?
It's something I genuinely enjoy. I really do. It's kind of frustrating how much harder it is to do, especially, again, I'm lucky in Japan, but when I'm not in Japan, it's frustrating how hard this can be. You know, if I'm in New York City, the big stores don't really carry any movies or games anymore. There's a couple small stores, but the prices there are outrageous, and it doesn't make sense to go there. Like, there's really no middle ground. It's like, you can go here and get nothing, or you can go here and spend like $100 for a game that really shouldn't cost $100.
I remember being scandalized by the prices at Video Games New York in 2001.
Yeah.
I can only imagine what they are like now.
Yeah, it's gone up. It's gone up. You know,
so I'm going to... Like, do you think the bubble's going to burst and they're going to go down again, or are we stuck now?
I think everything's going to burst in the next year or so, at least here in the U.S.
Well, tariffs, I've had a good run.
Yeah. I think if your primary consideration for purchasing games, or really any media, is convenience, I suppose it's probably more convenient to purchase new games than it ever has been. If you want something that is a mainstream game or even indie games, I mean, I shouldn't write them off because, again, the ability to download things digitally has opened the door to, you know, hundreds of publishers and designers who would never have had access, because Best Buy is not going to stock those games, right? You know, Toys R Us is not going to stock those games. But now that you have a digital marketplace, you can publish when you normally couldn't. But like you said, if you're looking for something that's even slightly off the beaten path, the well-beaten path, you know, Best Buy didn't stock anything that wasn't going to sell. That, I mean, that's the bottom line. And if it did, it's because someone didn't give me a note saying, pull this off the shelf because we're not going to sell any more copies of, you know, fill in the blank. It really was a, which sounds like a terrible game. It sounds like a store that Stu might run. But, you know, it, at the end of the day, it's, hey, it's capitalism. We're only going to sell things that we know are going to make money, unless you have a marketplace with very little overhead to run, in which case you can sell weird little niche games that suddenly blow up, like Hollow Knight or something crazy like that.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't feel like I have any final thoughts. I do miss the days of just, you know, going to the store and browsing and sometimes being surprised by something that I see and saying, oh, I got to grab that. But, you know, I don't know. Like, I'm okay leaving that in the past. I just feel like video games as a whole have kind of moved away from that. There's not as much unpredictability about video games. It's not like people are out there saying, hey, someone just invented the idea of a platform action game. What weird stuff can we do with this? It's much more about iteration, refinement, or even not even that much. Just saying, hey, I liked this game when I was a kid. I'm going to make a game just like it. And so, you know, it's a different era of video games. There are many, 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 many more video games coming out on a daily basis than used to come out on a monthly basis. So it's easy to get sort of overwhelmed. Digital storefronts have really opened up and to a certain degree democratized video game creation and publishing. So you do have the boutique, you know, smaller physical publishers like Limited Run, Special Reserve, et cetera, that are publishing some of these games, some of these indie games in a physical form, but even we can't keep up, you know, like,
yeah.
Picking our release schedule for Limited Run releases, trying to balance like big crowd pleasers versus indie games that deserve attention is really challenging because we only have, you know, so many slots we can fill on a monthly basis. And we could publish many more games than that, but they're all going to lose money because customers only have so much money to spend. So yeah, again, it, like Jeff said, it comes down to capitalism and the idea of physical games and retailing games really does come down to what's it worth these days. And I guess giving up shelf space for video games, unless it's something like Call of Duty or Assassin's Creed or Mario, it's just too big of a risk. And so things have changed. It's just been an evolutionary process, but I am happy to have experienced kind of the evolution of game retail from its very early days and been able to participate in that to a certain degree. Not that this is a celebration of capitalism per se, but just being able to sort of build a relationship with the games that I love by, you know, in the early days, I only had so much money. So when I bought something, I was stuck with it. I had to really make careful choices, and those games did resonate with me. Like the first game that I remember going out to buy at a store was Metroid for NES. And I went with, you know, a mission. I saw it. I'm sure I've mentioned this before too, but I was out shopping with my aunt, and I think the game was like $30 because that's what NES games cost in the early days. And she said, oh, I'll buy that for you. And I was like, no, I need to buy this myself because I've saved up for this. And it's, you know, like something that I've really had my heart set on. So I feel like I should pay my own money for it. I was a weird kid. Yeah, I don't know why I didn't just say like, yes, please. Now I can buy two games. But I was stupid that way. And because I was stupid that way, I didn't have any game besides Metroid for about 3 or 4 months. So I really connected with it, and it forced me to understand how Metroid worked, which was very confusing at the time. So who knows, you know, it's one of those Rastan moments for Stuart in my world. Like, what would have happened if I had said, yes, please buy me Metroid, and I will also buy Chubby Cherub? And
ooh,
then I would be very sad and hate video games again because Chubby Cherub is not good.
But One thing I'm wondering about, though, is that there are less bookstores today than there were in the 90s, but there's still a lot of bookstores. Like, I can still buy books in a lot of different places. I wonder why bookstores have continued to exist in a way that video game stores are kind of not. I don't know. Am I dumb for asking that question? I don't understand.
Books are cheaper to make. To print. Yeah. That's my guess, but yeah.
Yeah, no, the actual margin on a video game is extremely small compared to the margin on a book, which is much bigger. Like, there's more profit to be made. You know, they can mark a book down and still break even on it, whereas would they do that with a video game, it's like, well, we're just taking a loss. And, you know, you can destroy the cover of a book and send the destroyed cover back and you'll get a refund from the distributor. I don't know that video games always do that. But also, books have not fundamentally changed, technologically speaking, in about 600 years. They're paper that is bound, and maybe you have like different binding tech, but it's pretty much the same thing. It's a known quantity. Whereas video games, there's a new system and multiple new systems. There are no, like, there's no real competing platforms when it comes to books, I guess books or magazines or Kindle, but you know, Kindle is like a sidebar there. So, or ebooks, I guess.
Fonts.
Yeah. So the need to constantly refresh the technology video games don't have a long retail life anymore. Back in the NES days, like a good NES game, a popular NES game, could exist at retail for years. I mean, Nintendo reprinted some of its games like Punch-Out and Metroid and Zelda with alternate boxes and or different looking cartridges or whatever, just because they remained popular for 6 or 7 years. Aside from Mario Kart 8 for Switch, that's just not a thing. Fortnite or, you know, Minecraft, those games are extremely uncommon. Skyrim, Grand Theft Auto 5. Like, you can name the enduring games that continue to sell at retail on your hands, and that wasn't the case back in the day. So I think it's just a very volatile market with a very, very small profit margin and constant fluctuation and change. So, yeah, it's rough. It's rough.
It's even then, those games are only evergreen for a generation, and then they make you buy them again on the next thing.
Such as Mario Kart 8.
Yeah.
And Skyrim, and so on and so forth.
Yep.
Anyway, I think that's a pretty good journey in a sort of meandering, anecdotal way, which is always the best. Through the history of video game retail, we didn't get into hard facts about, you know, sales figures or here's the name of the guy who masterminded video game retail distribution, blah, blah, blah. I feel like actually the evolution of video game retail was much more organic than that. There was no central shadowy figure pulling the strings and inventing how retail worked. It was mostly just like video games slotted into the existing distribution networks. You know, famously, Nintendo sold the NES and got it into nationwide distribution thanks to Worlds of Wonder because they were kiting off Teddy Ruxpin's popularity. Like, here's an electronic talking teddy bear, and here's a video game with a robot guy. It's the same thing, same picture. And that allowed them to kite in. But, you know, it was really just kind of figuring out how to take advantage of existing retail channels. And then they sort of mutated and adapted over time and eventually shrank down to nothing. And video games no longer exist at retail. So, you know, a quick life cycle, like a locust or cicada or something.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I think it was the question of, is this a toy or is it something toy adjacent? And over the past 40 years, it's gone from toy adjacent to its own thing to now, I mean, for a while, it's closer to movies. I mean, like you were saying, the idea of, like, I say this as someone who went to go see Kraven the Hunter last night against my best judgment. But, you know, that's a movie that came out 3 weeks ago. It's down to one theater because that's the only interest it has at this point. So unless you are a Grand Theft Auto 5 or a Skyrim, you're not on the shelf anymore. So they have carved out their own niche as big box stores and small mom and pop stores decided how to market this and how to make money off of them. So,
All right. Well, video games, they're fun to buy, but they used to be more fun to buy. Jeff, thank you very much for prompting this discussion. Thanks, Diamond and Stuart, for joining this discussion.
Thank you.
I will tell you that this podcast, let me check. I think this is a patron exclusive episode.
It is.
It's a shame because I feel like
by patron for patron.
Beep, beep. Yeah. I feel like the cool kids who, the not so cool kids who listen to free episodes would have enjoyed this, but tough luck. That's what happens when you don't re-up your subscription to Retronauts.
Sucks to be you.
So yeah, I don't need to go through the spiel on how you can subscribe to Retronauts. Thank you for listening and subscribing to Retronauts, those of you who are listening and subscribed to this episode. And Jeff, thank you for subscribing and supporting the show. Hope you've enjoyed this conversation.
I have.
Early on a Sunday morning.
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, as I've said before, like Homer Simpson said, you know, why do I have three kids and zero money? I have, you know, zero kids and three money. So I'd rather give it to you guys to continue discussing things that I enjoy and that other people should too, because God damn it, they should. So that's the end of it.
Well, we appreciate it. Where can we find you on the internet if you like to be found on the internet?
Oh, well, yeah. So as I said, I'm not part of the industry at all. I'm just an attorney here in Cleveland. So if you type my name in, it's unique enough in Google that I'm probably the first result for Jeff Vlasic.
And you are.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, no, my picture is probably about 10 years old now. So I just, there's more lines and a little more gray in my hair in real life. But yeah, if you're looking for a management side employment attorney, I don't sue companies. I defend companies. So if that's what you're into, feel free to reach out. But no, my goal here is always just to promote what was a hobby and is now just part of my life, as it is all of us here on the podcast. So,
would you represent any of us pro bono?
So in other words, I wouldn't get paid. Actually, I know how much you guys make because I help pay for it. So it's kind of it's a bit. But what kind of trouble are you in, Stu? Do you want to talk when we wrap up?
Yeah, maybe later. You know, eventually one of these days I'm going to say something actionable. You know. And that's
so I only can practice in America, so I don't know the King's Bench whatever it is that goes on over there. So
you'd look great in a powdered wig, though.
That's true.
I might be in America. I might be in America for a few days this year. So, and if that's the case, I will try and commit a crime.
Well, yes, if either you or Diamond get in trouble, I don't know anything about Japanese law or British law. So the only person I could defend is probably Jeremy. Mm-hmm.
Well, when Diamond and Stuart sue me, I will definitely call your call on you to help. All right. Diamond, where can we find you on the internet?
Go to Fight Club. F-E-I-T, that's my last name. C-L-U-B, that's an English word you already know. My name is Fight Club on most services, or my website, fightclub.me. It's my own little corner of the website. I should probably update it soon, but, you know, it works. It has my name and how you pay me. It's all that I need.
Stuart?
I'm on Blue Sky, stuartjip.bluesky.social or whatever it is, and you can find my words about video games, most of them are swear words, on there, and also you can follow my increasingly confusing webcomic, Mary Hell.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, at jparrish.bluesky.social, or bisky.social, I guess it is.
Bisky.
Is how they parse it. You can find me here on Retronauts on my YouTube channel, Jeremy Parrish. And finally, doing stuff at limitedrungames.com, making cool stuff to put into physical editions of video games that you have to pre-order or buy at retail, at limited run retail, or at, you know, game shows, trade shows, and things like that, for the retro events. Our stuff shows up there a lot. It's weird. Sometimes I go and I'm like, oh, I created stuff in this thing that they're selling for four times what we originally sold it for. Neat. I have value. Anyway, video games, they're great. Buy one today.